beat your head soars up from the air.
Greetings, programs. We are back for season 4 of the Digital Press Podcast. And where this is our 4th anniversary, it is also the 20th anniversary of the United States launch of the Sony PlayStation. Mm. So here we have a original SCPH-1001 launch unit in box. And we've got this model here, which is allegedly one of the best audio CD players out there. Audiophiles swear by it. The ones that have the composite, loose composite ports on the back, and not the Sony multi-video output port. Although, no, this has the multi-AV out too.
They all have both.
Even the original ones.
Well, yep. So this one also has the parallel I/O port. It's got the cover on it.
Yep, which you could put a Game Shark in.
Yeah.
Sony never made any kind of official hardware for that, but that was primarily used in the developer kits, because most PlayStation 1s had the hardware in them to replicate the dev kit, and then Sony made a home unit available for independent developers called the Net Euros, but that's another story for another time. And here we have the PlayStation ONE, the PlayStation 1. Which is their bargain.
Is that how you say it, O-N-E?
No, but I want to spell it out for the people listening, for the people, all 10 of them.
Well, it's funny because, you know, we all call the PlayStation in general the PSX, which is never an official title.
That was like the development name, wasn't it, or something like that?
Yes, sort of.
Because I remember it being used in like early game magazines,
right,
and stuff like
and
that.
And then they actually made a product called the PSX.
Yeah, very confusing.
Right, it was like that VCR.
It was a PlayStation 2 with a built-in DVR. It was for Japan region only. And it was actually called PlayStation X. Mm-hmm. But the SKU was PSX.
Yeah.
So that, you know, confused people in Japan.
Yeah.
But not so much here, because you couldn't get it here. So
I still sometimes refer to it as the PSX. It's just to distinguish PSX, PS1.
Yep. PS, PSX, PS1 with the number 1.
Yeah, okay.
PS1, O-N-E,
yeah.
Which is this baby model here. So, the PlayStation. 20 years ago, it was originally conceived as a CD-ROM add-on for the Super Nintendo, and also potentially a standalone unit similar to the Sharp Twin Famicom or JVC XI,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
A combination hardware of a cartridge system and a CD system, or an add-on similar to the Sega CD, where it would snap on through an extension or parallel port, and it would access the CPU of the main system, but it would provide a CD media reader and also probably some extra memory.
Yeah, probably
for,
you know, more color.
Yeah, more color depth.
Like that, yeah.
To be able to, a video bus, to be able to process the streaming video coming off of the CDs. So, Sony had partnered with Nintendo and they were developing the hardware and the operating system for it. And the business venture made its way all the way to a prototyping stage, which was pretty common knowledge. But we recently spoke about, and the internet recently saw, that the son of an ex-employee of Olaf Olafsson, who was a head of Sony during that time, who was paid to clean out Olaf's office and quote-unquote throw away everything that he found or put it in, you know, some kind of storage, went home with a box of what he thought was something interesting. You know, oh, look, this video game hardware. Maybe my kids will know what it is. And it turned out to be one of the actual prototype PlayStation, Super Nintendo PlayStations.
Did he find out if it was functional or not?
He's not done it yet. No.
Yeah. And he's being cautious, which is really great. You know, it's almost odd that someone on the internet is taking precaution not to damage something.
Yeah.
Well, what happened was, Last I heard, again, the guy's father lives in the Philadelphia area and still lives there. And I believe he left everything there. When the kid went back to Denver, he left all the stuff there because he's like, well, you know, I guess for whatever the reason, he didn't feel like he would have the opportunity or that there was anyone in his area that could look at it. I don't know what the deal was. But he has said, last I saw, he said he still doesn't feel like he wants to sell it.
Yeah, but,
you know, they'll probably play cartridges at the very least. Probably at least a functional Super Nintendo.
It has a Famicom cartridge in it.
I mean, it's got the thing.
It has a Famicom cartridge in it, either a prototype or maybe something that, you know, talk to the OS, like, you know, like the Game Boy Player needs the disc. Maybe that cartridge has BIOS in it or something for the CD-ROM.
I mean, at the end of the day, I think people are mistaken when they think that if this kid takes this device to an expert, you know, whoever it is, and they get it to work, that somehow does anything for the community. I mean, it doesn't. It's a standalone device. I mean,
there's probably no CD software that would work for it.
Right. They developed two games. The two games were in development. One was eventually released. I think it was the Sherlock Holmes game that went to Sega CD, and the other one was some weird space sim that nobody knows what happened to.
So. And I believe that Sony of America right now does have some prototype units in their possession that they do trot out for special visitors or, you know, historical tour type things.
I saw Jerry Jessup's Facebook page that he posted the... It looks like the Sony like gift shop at their headquarters, but there is this multiple display cases with, you know, all kinds of stuff in there.
Yeah, all their great retail releases throughout the year, celebrating the 20-year anniversary. I will share that picture on our Facebook page for the Digital Press Podcast, so if you want to check that out, I'll make sure to post that. It's got some interesting stuff. So, for those of you who don't know the story, Sony had partnered with Nintendo to work on this hardware, and Nintendo had also partnered with Philips, and it was the Consumer Electronics Show of 1991 that Nintendo, on stage, announced to the retail world that they will be partnering with Philips.
Olafson basically did one of those things like at the Academy Awards. He almost did like a Michael Keaton from this year where he's like, and the contract goes to, and he's like, no, Philips, what?
And the reasoning that I've seen is that Sony had in their contract with Nintendo originally that they basically had all control and rights and distribution and publishing. They basically had the level of control over the CD-ROM media and everything that was going to be published and produced on the Nintendo PlayStation that Nintendo had over the cartridge hardware.
Yeah.
And Nintendo being, you know, as aggressive as they are with control over their stuff was like, no, we're not having that. And instead of talking to Sony about it or renegotiating or whatever, they just went with the partnership with Philips, which is ironic because then they took two of their most beloved licensed properties and said to Philips, go ahead, you can make games without, you know, our watchful eye.
Yeah.
You know, produce some Zelda games and produce some Mario games. Run wild. And
I think that was to get out of... I think that was the settlement to get out of the Philips deal.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was how they basically got out of it. Say, all right, well, what's it going to take to get off of this contract? Because, you know, we can't do this. There's a lot of... Even in reading Console Wars, I mean, unfortunately, Blake, who was with us the last episode, he couldn't talk to enough Nintendo people that would, you know, readily admit, give, you know, tell the real story. They just wouldn't do it. But a lot of people feel like Nintendo dumped Sony right there, you know, sort of on the stage, but that they really had no intention of working with Philips at that point either. So I guess at some point
it was a lesser of two evils kind of
situation. It was almost the impression I got was that the Nintendo people obviously, Yamauchi all at the top, that they felt like, you know something, this CD stuff, nah, let's not do this. This is not going to work. And it was obvious because they didn't even do it for the N64. So I think they made, for whatever the reason, Nintendo made some sort of decision that we're just not going to do CD. And so they just said, well, Sony, no. It's Philips contract? Nope. Let's just get out of it. And then it was briefly, there was a chance that the PlayStation would have been licensed by Sega, yes. distributed by Sega as a like a Sega PlayStation. But Sega of Japan, in their infinite wisdom, sorry internet trolls, but in their infinite wisdom, they decided, no, let's just do our own console. And that became the Saturn.
So, from that fateful Consumer Electronics Show onward, Ken Kutaragi, who apparently had been working with Nintendo almost behind Mother Sony's back. He was working behind Sony's back with them, kind of clandestine deal. Like, you know, let's, because Sony wasn't really interested in creating a home video game system at the time, and Kutaragi had the vision. He said, this is going to be good for us and good for everybody. And when Nintendo pulled the plug, he said, we've got, you know, so much R&D and so much that we've worked on this. Let's, you know, we've got a couple years here. Let's do this. We can enter into this. I mean, this marketplace is kind of tumultuous right now, and this is an opportunity for us to get in and appeal to a demographic that neither Nintendo or Sega is appealing to at this point in time. And then 3 years after that, in Japan, they launched the PlayStation with the fantastic launch lineup of A4 Evolution, Crime Crackers, a Parodius game, a Parodius collection, which
all
is...
All right, that's decent.
That's a good one. Goku Sky Atsushi, which is a Mahjong game. Which if you're in Japan, you got to have a Mahjong game at launch. Maybe three Mahjong games at launch.
Another Mahjong game.
And yes. Okay, so they had two, which is acceptable. I think three is the number to go with. But they had two. Station Mazin Mahjong. Nekutsu Oyaku, which I'm not sure. I think that might be a... Let's see.
Third of their lineup. Third of their launch lineup was Mahjong.
I guess that was popular.
I don't know what that game is, but Ridge Racer was in their launch lineup, and a game called Tama. So it had a, I don't want to say not a stellar launch lineup, but it didn't have a killer app at launch, outside of maybe Ridge Racer, which, you know, there's no shortage of racing games out there at the time. It's a gorgeous racing game for the time. But it's also a very limited racing game. It has like two tracks, three tracks.
Right, yeah, it's very limited.
It's an arcade, you know, it's a sit-down arcade game, and it emulates that almost exactly and for home consoles. Being a Namco release, they're, you know, great at making these, at the time, they're great at making these compact arcade-style games, but not sprawling, huge... racing games the size of something like a Gran Turismo or a...
Right. Well, I mean, if it's an arcade game, you got to figure... I mean, there's no reason to have more than, like, six levels. Nobody's going to get to it.
Exactly. Yeah, your three-minute time period where you're playing, and then you inevitably fail, and you put some more quarters in and play for another 3 minutes. So, a year later, almost, in September 9th, 1995 in the United States.
PlayStation had actually good launch.
at a pretty decent launch title.
I think it was probably one of the best launches.
Yes, for the standards of the United States and for the standards of what had come before, it was a very respectable launch title. You had Battle Arena Toshinden, which didn't play great, but it looked really good. I remember that being really visually impressive. At the time, home computers didn't have 3D cards in them, so you couldn't get that kind of fighting game experience. Or if they did have 3D cards, I mean, we were talking, like, the infancy of it. Saturn had a mess of a Virtua Fighter game. At launch, the first Virtua Fighter, Sega had to make concessions for how bad it was by offering through the mail, if you sent them like a proof of purchase that you had purchased the original Virtua Fighter, they would send you a remixed version. It came in like a cardboard sleeve.
They had to do the same thing with Daytona.
Yeah.
Daytona was a disaster. It was a buggy disaster when it came out.
So Battle Arena Toshinden was a pretty polished looking fighting 3D fighting game in comparison. ESPN Extreme Games, which is like a downhill racer.
It was a lot of fun. It was awful.
It's one of those games.
You could play like the Street Luge or the rollerblades, right? Then you play like bikes.
I was actually playing it the other couple of weeks ago with friends. We were playing it, and what I kind of noticed right away, and I hadn't played this since college, was that it was ridiculously difficult.
Yeah, you fall down a lot.
Ridiculously.
Crash into the like. Well, there's like gates you have to go through.
Yeah, but it wasn't even that. It was like there was like I said, there was all kinds of different extreme sports people. So there was like rollerbladers and skateboarders.
This
and
was
losers, losers.
This was around the time that extreme sports was really starting to take off.
Yeah, a few years prior to Tony Hawk Pro Skater.
So it was just difficult because you had to, you could only do anything. Oh, and there was bicycle too.
Like
a mountain bike guy. And it was the only way to like do anything was to be on the mountain bike.
Weren't you able to kick people? You were able to kick.
Yeah, it was like
road
rash. You could kick people and punch them and stuff. It was like road rash.
For all intents and purposes, it's a terrible looking, terrible playing game, but it was popular, and at the time it was one of the top sellers. It's, you know, it's been on. It was in their greatest hits line. And if you look at the metrics of that game, it wound up, you know, in the life of the system being one of the top sellers.
When I was a freshman in college in the dorm, there was one kid who had actually the PlayStation with him. He was probably the only person in the building that had a PlayStation. And even though he had many games, it probably, you know, 10, 11, 12 games, and the system had been out for about a year. We just continue to play one extreme or extreme or whatever.
Glutton for punishment.
It's just, I don't know why.
So then you also had Kilik, the DNA Imperative. Was that a first-person shooter?
I don't know.
Or a
in the back of the box.
Isometric strategy?
No, this is a later edition, so I don't... Oh, no, there it is.
It's on
Kilik.
There.
Kilik. It looks like a third-person kind of floating...
Okay.
Three triangle contraption that's shooting things.
Okay, so it's possibly like a descent type game.
Yeah.
I mean, I vaguely remember it. It's one of those ones. In my years of managing a Funko Land, most of those long box games would always come into the store without the long boxes.
Yeah.
Oh, that's another thing. The launch of PlayStation, all the software
was weird,
long boxes.
It was weird because they had three different types.
Is there any over here?
All those boxes, because they had the hard plastic ones that I think they supposedly ran out of.
Yes, so
they had to get
some from Sega.
Yeah, they started using like the old Sega CD like plastic ones. But then they used to have these like cardboard ones that only sort of like looked like the plastic, the hard plastic.
They
ones.
Had a glossy cardboard. Greg found some.
Yeah.
So these long box titles were basically
this is the one that was
first
supposed
few
to
months.
The original one. It was like the hard, you have the ribbed plastic on the spine.
Rib for your pleasure.
Yeah, there you go, pretty much.
PlayStation is...
There's that one.
And these are horrible, these long cases.
But then they had like one that was like this, Sega but it was CD. Just like all cardboard. Like it didn't have like the plastic.
I would like to know, I don't know if this has ever been researched, what moron or group of morons came up with that long jewel case that was used on the Sega CD and those early PlayStation games and the Saturn.
Like the 3DO.
Who did that?
Well,
3DO had
if I had to guess, make an
long,
educated guess.
The
but they weren't,
they weren't like
the
that,
clear
but,
plastic
yeah.
ones.
No, these like are those? These are interchangeable with either Sega CD or Saturn.
Yeah.
They're exactly the same.
But not 3DO.
No.
3DO
it had its other
was
long box.
Like the 3DO boxes were similar to
they
a
were like the
CD.
Early DVD cases where it was DVD, the early DVD cases, a lot of them were just like a long sheet of cardboard folded and like one little plastic thing at the top at the front that
wasn't it inspired by like didn't music CDs sometimes
yes
come
that's
like
what
that?
I was gonna say
it did
and
yeah,
well
music
not,
CDs sometimes came in those like long pat boxes I think
so my guess first of all is that these long boxes are probably a security measure against shoplifting because they're big and they're difficult to put in a bag or down your pants. And that was the reason that the music industry had originally created.
Want to test that?
Those
theory?
Compact disc long boxes, the they empty really cardboard boxes, yeah. And they're in the later era of 3DO stuff when they were getting into the like bargaining of like just dumping 3DO software. They switched over to those long cardboards with the actual standardized CD jewel cases. Now, I have a suspicion that one of the reasons that PlayStation did well, maybe not the reason why it won the console war for its generation or, you know, outsold whatever else was out there, but it had a lot to do with it, is because they used standardized compact disc casing. It made sense. It was logical. You could buy more games, fit more games in your personal collection. You could display them easily on a shelf. If you broke one, you could go out and get a replacement one, you know, at not much cost.
Stores are probably more willing to stock more copies because they could fit more on the
shelf. Exactly. It was easier for inventory management in retail establishments. And Sony could, you know, pay pennies on the dollar for them. If Sony was handling all the distribution of these, it was very easy for them to get these from standard distributors. They weren't these ridiculous custom-sized long boxes, so hooray for standardized
CD jewel
cases. When
did they switch? Do you remember when they made the switch? It must have been a few months. Sometime, maybe the end of 95, early 96?
It was before the end of the first year of PlayStation's retail run, and I believe only the launch titles were in the long boxes, and they weren't in the long boxes for very long.
Some later, some like within the launch window, like I think Mortal Kombat 3 and the first Tekken.
Yep, you'll find there's a bunch of launch titles that continued to sell well, and you'll see that they transitioned from the long box into standard jewel cases.
And I have, yeah, I mean, I don't.
There's a few that are only available in the jewel cases because I don't think they ever made it past that launch window.
Yeah, and it always annoys me because I don't collect the long boxes. I'm just not going to do that. It's ridiculous. And a lot of the games that I enjoy that were early releases, they never got another. They never got like a regular black labeled jewel case release. They just went right to the greatest hits. Like Alien Trilogy is one that just it never was released right. It just went right to the greatest hits.
Well, people have made. Could print off your own version at home. So you also had in their launch lineup NBA Jam Tournament Edition. Which
that was on every
I didn't play, but that was what, that was one of those where you'd see the Acclaim ad and it would have literally every console's version of NBA Jam like stacked up. They'd have the Game Boy cartridge and the Super Nintendo cartridge. And you also had Raiden Project, which is a great collection of those arcade top-down shooters.
Raiden? I think it's Raiden.
Raiden's the guy from Metal Gear and Street Fighter, right? Raiden is the shooter.
You sure?
Raiden's the guy from Mortal Kombat.
The internet will correct me if I'm wrong.
It's Christopher Lambert.
Yep.
Power Surf 3D Tennis, which I've heard is terrible. I've never played it. Rayman, which was on everything also. But it, you know, that's a franchise that has subsisted. You know, it
died out for a little while. Then it came back.
Did that star Dustin Hoffman?
Rayman?
Yes. There's a level where you throw the toothpicks on the ground and you have to pick them all up. You have to count them all, and then you go to the final levels. You go to Las Vegas with Tom Cruise
and watch Wheel of Fortune.
Yep. Ridge Racer. That's the only release that was both in Japan and the United States at launch. Street Fighter, the movie, the game. So you have two "the"s in the title, which is always a good sign. And Total Eclipse Turbo, which was a space shooter.
The sequel to The Heart.
Which one?
The sequel to Total Eclipse of the Heart. The sequel.
Yes. Is that a Wilson Phillips?
No.
Who sang Total Eclipse of the Heart? Come on. You guys know this.
I don't. Yeah, it's another one. I forget her name.
Whoever it is, she's flying the spaceship. So
was it Chrissy Hynde?
Possibly. If my wife was here, she would absolutely know it.
Really?
She's anything from 1950 to 1979. She's like an encyclopedia of useless pop culture and music knowledge. Anything from 1980 onwards, it gets foggier and foggier as you get closer to the modern era. Now she knows like nothing about music. I'm the same way.
Bonnie Tyler.
Bonnie Tyler. Bonnie Tyler. Okay. So Bonnie Tyler is flying a spaceship in Total Eclipse Turbo. The PlayStation itself, like several other consoles of its day, of that era, it's a 32-bit processor, but it's a single 32-bit core. It's a RISC processor, RISC, and it runs in 33.8 megahertz, approximately. Now, I believe on paper, the 3DO might have even had a faster RISC processor, but it didn't have the same type of CPU core. And the Saturn has three processors, right?
Two CPUs. Four processors. But two CPUs. Well, that was what happened, was the Sega Japan...
It was underpowered,
was
right?
Like, oh my god, the PlayStation is so much... is a lot more powerful. Let's throw another CPU on there.
It's got 2 megabytes of RAM and one dedicated for video, which helped a lot because it was one of the first CD systems that I felt didn't seem to struggle in any one area. It was a great, like, if it wasn't like A+ across the board, it was certainly did very, very well with whatever developers threw at it. It could handle a polygonal 3D game without feeling like it was really taxing the system. It could do the 2D side-scrolling things or fighting games. It could do arcade ports. It had enough memory, enough RAM, and enough computing processing power to run emulation within, you know, the
and the
game.
The SDKs were highly compatible with SDKs that were being used on PC games. So porting from PC to PlayStation, I guess vice versa, was much easier, which is why you're just giving a reason. The reason I always felt that the PlayStation destroyed was that they got all of these, I mean, generic, some were just generic, but they got all of these PC titles that, like, at the time, I didn't have PlayStation, I was just playing the games on PC, but if you had PlayStation, even though the graphics were worse, you could still have it.
Yeah.
They had a good version of Doom.
Right. They had John Carmack said it was the best home version. It's like on the box. Mm. It says like it has his thumbs up that it runs the fastest. It had like levels from
Final Doom.
Had like the Final Doom built into it, and you could network with a link cable PlayStation to PlayStation, and you could play Doom. You know, one-on-one deathmatch. You could have your exciting back-to-back LAN party with two CRT televisions. In the same room. Yeah, it was exciting times.
So were you at a Funko Land at that time?
I was. I was managing a Funko shortly after launch. I started in 97, so I got in a little late, but I was there for, you know, a lot of the excitement, like the big like wave of PlayStation kind of taking over. And I was frequenting as a shopper before that, so
Yeah, I just, you know, again, the PlayStation seemed to, mainly because Saturn was such a disaster, but the PlayStation did a number of things. Again, like I said, you could port the PC games, like you said. It had all these arcade ports that the other systems, a lot of them, didn't have. And you had a lot of the third-party titles. You know, I have one here as Contra, for instance. Somewhere in here is Castlevania. A lot of these that the third-party developers like...
the classic Castlevania Symphony of the Night.
Right.
It's, you know, should be on everyone's top 10 for the Sony PlayStation.
But again, you know, Konami put a lot of stuff out on the PlayStation. Capcom did. They did very little on the Saturn. They did even less on the N64, especially decent ones.
Yeah, it hit the sweet spot for a lot of the big developers that we saw throughout the 16-bit era. Capcom, Konami, Square, Naughty Dog moved in as a first-party developer for Sony, or a 1.5 or a 2 second party, whatever you want to call it. They were working exclusively with Sony.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's something that really came out of the PlayStation was eventually you had, like, Naughty Dog and other developers, many of which came from PC, but they got into the consoles with the PlayStation and just grew and, you know, just blew up, really.
Insomniac, right?
Yeah, Insomniac was a major company. I mean, you could just run down the list. Atlas, Working Designs.
Rockstar, the first Grand Theft Auto. That Grand Theft Auto was most popular on the PlayStation.
Activision, you know, came back in a big way on PlayStation. I mean, the Activision that we know today, kind of, you know, like they were doing stuff before. They still existed as a company,
yeah,
from the old 8-bit computer era and cartridge systems prior to NES, but Activision didn't have the kind of activity on NES, Genesis, and Super Nintendo that they did on PlayStation and forward.
Yeah. And Working Designs.
Namco, another, you know.
Yeah, Namco. Well, Namco was tight with Sony, no question.
Yeah.
And Working Designs, they continued to port a lot of Japanese RPGs and shooters and stuff like that. Pretty much only to the PlayStation. They may have done some Saturn stuff, but they didn't do anything for Nintendo.
Yeah, I was discussing with a friend of mine this past week during the anniversary that I originally purchased a Saturn first. You know, I was a big Sega fan. I mean, I liked everything. I never played favorites, but to me, the PlayStation was kind of an untested waters kind of thing, and I wanted to see where it was going, what games would it have that were exclusive to it that would interest me. And the first year, there wasn't much. I was impressed with Battle Arena Toshinden visually. I might have played a demo and wasn't quite as excited about it as I was for something like Virtua Fighter 2 or the Daytona games or Virtua Cop. And I felt like Sega had a shot with Saturn. It had all the potential, and it just was struggling. And as I saw more and more on PlayStation and more on Saturn in year 2 and year 3, it just felt perpetually like everything on Saturn, whether it was a first-party, core-developed piece of software by Sega for the machine, exclusively for the hardware, or something ported from PC or from another platform or that was a multi-platform release, like everything towards the middle of the life of the Saturn, in the United States anyway, felt like it struggled. Like, everything felt like it was struggling with the architecture of the system, the polygonal stuff, the textures, you know, there's a few standout gems here and there, but I'd say the majority of stuff on Saturn, it might be decent, but it just, in comparison to PlayStation, everything I picked up and played on PlayStation, but both before I owned my own and during my early days with it, it felt like, boy, this feels like it was either made for this system or that the system really has a lot going on under the hood, where it runs smooth, looks smooth, decent load times,
well,
you know, good video.
One of the big titles at that time on franchises was Tomb Raider, Eidos, but did you? I haven't played it on the Saturn in ages.
I finished it on Saturn, in fact, before I played it on PlayStation.
Is it better on the Saturn?
I think
the draw distance is better on the Saturn.
I think Eidos might have led production on Saturn with that title and then brought it to PlayStation as a port or you know, co-produced one for Saturn, one for PlayStation. I played the Saturn one first. It's better. I think it has a better color depth on PlayStation. I think it's okay on Saturn. But, again, if you put them side by side, I'd probably have the same opinion that, like, it feels like it's struggling on Saturn versus the PlayStation. But it's Resident Evil, same thing. Like, it's on Saturn, it's on PlayStation, you put them side by side, and you can really see the extra bit of processing power or the clearly delineated development that, you know, a PlayStation game has versus Saturn, where it's kind of obvious that they have to work around this hardware architecture to get things to work the way that they need them to work.
Yeah.
So, it's...
Sorry, so you had the Saturn first, and then I guess you eventually got the PlayStation.
I did. It took a game of Tekken to convince me that I had played Tekken in the arcades, and I played it on PlayStation, and it was, like, identical.
Mm.
And it was, like, one of those moments, like, when you... I don't know if you played Super Mario Brothers in the arcades prior to playing it on an NES. Did you have that experience?
I couldn't recall.
I did. I recall playing the, you know, versus cabinet or whatever the equivalent was of the arcade version of Super Mario, and then I saw it on a home system, and it was like, this is... this is the same thing, and I had one of those kind of
epiphanies. Well, yeah, it was the same thing. It was the same thing.
It is. Same hardware, same board.
You know something? Nintendo, I just read in the latest Retro magazine, they were one of their columnists was talking about Excitebike versus Excitebike.
Yeah.
And him seeing it in the arcade and saying, you know, like, oh my God. And then he saw, like, his cousin or something had it for the NES, and he was like, it's just, how is this possible? It's the same game.
Because
the arcade is... I think they really did trick a lot of people into thinking, oh, this is arcade perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the thing. And I'm sure the arcade hardware for the original Tekken is different than what's in that PlayStation. It's probably close, but it was so damn perfect. And then the PlayStation had additional features. You know, you can unlock things and you save your progress, and it's like, wow, this is fantastic. Like, okay, I'm gonna get one. And I didn't get rid of my Saturn. I didn't sell it. I wasn't, you know, like, dumping it for PlayStation. But as the years went on, my Saturn library didn't really grow much more, and my PlayStation library started to grow exponentially. Retail, it didn't grow much more, but, you know, by default, I wasn't buying any either.
I remember being, I was in high school, I think I was a senior, and it was probably in 96, and one day at the end of the year, our art teacher, and now this guy was, you know, was well into his 50s, and he was telling us, like, his son, who was probably in his mid-20s at that point, or 30 years old, I don't know, something like that, and he's like, yeah, you know, my son has this new PlayStation, and he's like, he's got this game where you crash into each other with cars. He's like, it's unbelievable.
Destruction Derby?
No, it was Twisted Metal. Oh, Twisted. He's like, he was just fascinated by this thing. Yeah. Oh, really? So one of our classmates, he wound up getting the PlayStation probably for Christmas or something over that time period. And when Twisted Metal came out, he got it, and... You know, we snuck in a PlayStation because our art class was, the art classroom was, like, way out of the way from everything else, and nobody walked by or whatever. And at the end of the year, we were just, you know, horsing around anyway.
One of those high school TVs with, like, the metal,
cart
with the TV, like, chained to the top so no one could take it.
Well, I don't know where they were going with it, but.
Wheeling it down the hall and dumping it in their Camaro or.
Yeah, I forget what. Yeah, somehow we got. I think he may have had a TV all the time in there, or what the hell the deal was. But they had the TV, and then we snuck in the PlayStation and Twisted Metal, and he was like, he couldn't be happier. He just sat in the back playing the PlayStation while we just did whatever.
That's awesome.
That was the first game that I played on the PlayStation. It was Twisted Metal, and it was a great game. And you know what it was? I was definitely kind of a Nintendo fanboy, I guess. I really, you know, I loved their first party stuff, and so I just waited. You know, I was like, nah, I'm not gonna get into. I want to see what Nintendo comes out with. I really had no interest in the Saturn, and you know, Nintendo kind of kept my interest because they were still producing, like, good titles. I mean, Super Metroid was in '94, but. They had Yoshi's Island in 95, and they still made some SNES games that I was playing. And like I said, the college roommate had it. We played ESPN Extreme games and some other stuff. And I got the N64, and I just kind of forgot about the PlayStation for a few years. And some of my other friends had it. We played, like, the EA Sports games or something. And I would say probably around... I think around the end of 99, I bought a new PC, and it was a lot more powerful than one I had before, 2000. And right around that time, they developed Bleem.
the best, worst name for a piece of software ever.
Now, I would have brought in my copy of Bleem, but I traded it in to the Show Press ages ago for like $2. They came out with Bleem, and I was like, oh my God, you know, I could play Gran Turismo. This is incredible. which I've been playing, you know, at a friend's house constantly at that point. Gran Turismo 2, probably. And, you know, and it obviously worked like crap, but it still worked somewhat. Tuned everything down. And so, with Bleem, then I would go to, like, Funko Land or something, and I would buy PlayStation games. And so I had a stack of PS1 games that I, you know, for a couple of years, and...
And you didn't actually own a PlayStation?
I didn't even have a PlayStation. And then eventually they came up with better emulators that I... So I, then I would use it on that. And I don't think I got a PlayStation until, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, maybe?
That's interesting that, wow. like, the emulation of the time was, you know, capable and functional enough for you to go out and buy retail releases and actually play them.
Yeah, and one of my friends who I was hanging out with, he got a PS2 probably in the first year that it came out, and we would just, if there was a PS1 game that I had, we wanted to play, we'd just play it on there.
Yeah, Sony also did something that was not unheard of in video game console architecture. Sega had used similar processors in their Sega Master System or the SG-1000 or 3000 and carried that forward as like a coprocessor in the Genesis, so you could use your Master System games with just a little, a big adapter. Essentially, it's a little piece of thing inside this gigantic piece of plastic, but there's not much to it. The games will basically run if you could get the raw cartridge
just to connect the pins.
Sony carried their massive software library forward for the next two generations of consoles. I mean, this is really, we're talking about PS1, but it's noteworthy that they're one of the first to do it in a big way and carry it forward through three consecutive generations.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the other, I don't know, Mike, what your experiences were, but...
Well, I was in sixth grade at the time.
All right. Now, this is the other experience was from the early PlayStations was the early ones. I don't know, maybe they all did, the gray ones, but they would overheat a lot.
You had to turn them upside down.
So there was an urban legend. Well, you know, you open it, you put the disc in, you shut it, and then...
Yes, it's really messed up.
And you run it upside down.
Well, it's...
It's real voodoo shit. Like, put it in the freezer.
I'm a little internet famous for my articles on blowing into Nintendo cartridges. Mm. You can look those up. But there is some amount of truth to the turning it upside down thing. And what was actually determined, I think, by most people who, you know, have the engineering knowledge to know what was going wrong in the PlayStations, it's not so much a matter of the console overheating, it's that the laser diodes that run the disc reading lasers were not subpar, but they weren't the most robust, and they would either fall out of calibration easily, or they would become underpowered, like they'd kind of burn out from extensive use. Now, the heat of the console might have something to do with that, but I think it was just the general usage and wear and tear. And what turning it upside down would do was it would... The laser diode would be able to move... It was a floating lens that would move up and down, which would make the beam of light either, you know, wide or focused to read different tracks in the compact disc. And when you turn the thing upside down, it just dropped that floating lens, like... to the top of the... as close to the compact disc as possible. So it actually reduced the amount of space that the laser had to transmit the data, hit the CD, and bounce back. And that fixed most of the problems. It wasn't a matter of heat escaping from the unit better when it was upside down. It was just the... In fact, the entire module where the disc reader and the laser lens are on three pieces of rubber, and when you turn the entire thing upside down, that whole module like gets closer to the disc. It's pretty fascinating how this works. And you know, as the PlayStation lifespan went on, there are multiple hardware revisions. If you look at the bottom of the PlayStation, you'll see a serial number with like a 4-digit code and then a slash and then a multiple number digit code after that. And Sony revised the internal hardware multiple times, and they fixed some of those heat issues. They fixed some of the laser issues. They use different styles of CD-ROM drives.
They also were fighting piracy each through each iteration.
Oh, because that's this is when mod ships first started coming out, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Used to have, certain games used to have, like, the you need stealth mod ships, right?
Sure.
Games
the PlayStation was also one of the first home consoles or global consoles that was a victim of piracy on a massive scale. People engineered microchips with codes in them that would bypass the copy protection that was on the discs, and they could be the systems could be opened up and you could solder them in. They started very complex. Maybe 20 wires would have to be soldered to different points on the board, and then they became less complex, so like 4 or 5 wire chips, and then Sony revised the insides of the, you know, like, and it was
cat and mouse, constant.
Yeah, constantly. Like, I was working retail actively selling brand new PlayStations, and, like, you know, people would be buying them, and they'd come back and they'd go, oh, the mod chip I just bought doesn't work on this. I'd be like, it's not our problem. You can't, like, return it because a mod chip doesn't work. But, you know, a new hardware revision would come out, like, 1 month after the last one when piracy was a major issue, and it would sometimes correspond with major title releases, like a new Final Fantasy game or a new Resident Evil game would be coming out, and it would go hand in hand with a new hardware revision that was specifically made to block these chips that were being made. And you could go, and this was in the infancy of eBay, and you could go on eBay and people were selling like 100, you know, PlayStation copies, you know, send me a list of what you want. And eBay wasn't sophisticated enough at the time to have a handle on, like, how to stop people from doing that or take these auctions down in mass or block them from, you know, it wasn't in their terms and conditions. So people were getting away with it for a long time. Now,
it was a free-for-all. That was that time.
It was. It was. There was a lot of... It was, you know, video game, home console video game stuff occasionally hits Wild Wild West periods where, you know, people figure out how to do these things. You know, people in Hong Kong backwards engineer. They make chips, they make discs, they make cartridges, and all it takes is for the general populace to catch wind of it and for it to be affordable and easily accessible. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, like the
especially if it's unprecedented.
The 3DS, the original, or not the 3, the original Nintendo DS.
Oh, those are fortunes.
That stuff went crazy all around the world. You know, like, those things were, you could get them for less than $10 easily at any corner store, and they really put a dent in the market for...
Well, the Dreamcast, which was probably not going to work anyway, but they got killed with the... Because you just burn the game to a CD.
Yeah, and that was around the time that broadband was really taking off, so people were able to actually download these things.
Yeah, we've talked about that multiple times on this. Like, the Dreamcast suffered from the discs being able to be copied with no modifications to the system whatsoever. Sony, it never really got to that point. You always needed some type of piece of hardware or physical modification to the system, or at the very end of the lifespan of the system, a disc.
There was
discs that would work by themselves, and they would talk to the CPU of the system, say, this is a legal game, and then it would kind of freeze everything, and you would take the disc out and put the real disc in, and it would resume and boot the game.
Yeah, swap magic.
Swap
discs. It was like a Goldfinger that you used to had and you put into the parallel port.
Yeah, Sony actually removed the parallel port from the last models of the system because those...
It's all gone.
Yep, it's not on the PlayStation.
Actually, they took it off the gray one after a few years.
Yeah. Because they never made any actual hardware. They had, I would imagine, they thought at some point we're going to make hardware.
Yeah, what you do is you have like the thing in the back, like the little box of Goldfinger, and you would have a spring you would put inside.
Trick the door.
Yeah. So like when you could, this little button here, lid switch, you put the spring in there so that you could open the console without the system knowing that it was open, and you just swap the discs.
Yep.
It was simple.
Yeah, and you know, the general population, I think.
It was always sold as, like, you know, for imports.
Sure.
You know.
And that's good you bring that up because...
No, backups.
Imports and backups. Yeah.
My backups. I gotta have backups.
Because, old PC software, which was on magnetic media, that stuff really could get corrupted easily. Like, you spill something on it, you know, get a magnet too close to it. Those games, you had a legitimate reason to be able to back them up. Sometimes they would just corrupt, you know, for no reason. Like, hey, this disc is working fine today. Compact discs, they don't deteriorate as rapidly as a magnetic disc. I mean, we have determined that over the course of time, they can get pitting, they can deteriorate in some ways.
Just get damaged in general.
Yeah, they can be scratched, but there was no real legitimate reason to back up a CD-ROM unless you were prone to damage your own material, like break your own discs or scratch your own discs. But they were pretty sensitive. They were soft plastic. They didn't have a kind of like a polyurethane coating like on some of the more modern Blu-rays, which are more resistant to scratching. They were pretty sensitive. So it was like a gray area of whether or not it was reasonable to back up your PlayStation software.
So in conclusion, I guess then, would you say that the PlayStation's success was due to, you know, to me, I always thought it was right place, right time, in the sense that the Saturn was a debacle. Yeah. Nintendo took too long to come out with their system, which also had its drawbacks. And, you know,
I think that's fair.
I definitely think that it was a perfect storm of, it was,
and the Sony name. I mean, people knew it back then. You know, was it that Saturday Night Live? I remember that Tom Hanks and they're doing the game show, the Sabra game show, and he's like, "What's in this? Oh, this is very good, very good. It has Sony guts. Everything has Sony guts."
Yeah, it was a perfect storm of them hitting the right demographic with the right software. Standardizing a lot of things. I mean, they designed solid hardware, great controllers. They evolved controllers. They added things that were more standard on PC. They moved them into the home console market. It was easy to develop for, inexpensive for third-party developers to get on board with licensing and production of the software. Sony, you know, handled the distribution of the physical media, compact discs. It was a perfect time for those. Inexpensive media, you could sell a bargain game for $10, $20 and still make a profit. You know, there's a million different things that went right with the PlayStation. There were a million things that went wrong with the Saturn and the 3DO and the other 32-bit CD systems that came before this, or were, you know, its peers in the marketplace. It was wonderful, and it had such a longevity. It's still
also gaming during the 90s was constantly like growing and growing and growing, and it was ready for, I guess, another, like a third competitor. It was time for one to come in.
There was room in the market, yeah, and sure. There was also the PlayStation was one of those. It was on par with the arcade experience, what was left of the arcade experience in that mid-90s era. You know, you could get the arcade ports where only certain games could make their way to the 16-bit systems and be like, you know, like Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat were pretty close, and then they were wonderful on systems like PlayStation. But then you had, like, the 3D-type games in the arcade, like the sports games and stuff. They could make pretty good translations to the home system, so It was matching and keeping up with the arcades at the time. You had great third-party developers.
And like you said, when the arcade hardware would be based on PlayStation hardware, it would make ports a lot easier.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess companies like Namco, they had the foresight to start designing some of their arcade games on what would be the home specs for the PlayStation. And another interesting thing before we wrap up or move on, I mean, we could talk about PlayStation all day. There's just so much endlessly to talk about from a classic gaming perspective, from a, you know, enthusiast perspective, from a collector's perspective. Sony has so much, the sort of vast library. And one thing that it was really fascinating, it was with the demo discs, occasionally Sony would throw some oddball Japanese game on there that you couldn't get that kind of window into the world of Japanese software on the Super Nintendo or the Sega Genesis. Like, it was either stuff was fully released here and packaged and commercially available, or maybe you were you had a friend who got imports, or their you know family would go to Japan and bring home a bunch of games, or there was a video store that was renting you know odd import Japanese shooters or something, and you didn't know what it was, but the box looked interesting. Sony gave you like a level, like here's a Japanese game, like a shooter or a cooking game, or you know, something that maybe this will come out, maybe it won't. And it kind of inspired you to go like, hey, I got to get my hands on some of this stuff. And like you said, those cheat devices would allow you to play the import games. And like, even if you couldn't read the Japanese text, like you could fumble your way through a lot of them. Fighting games that never came out here, racing games that never came out here, like odd puzzle games or platformers. There was so much of that. And it was... That's not true. it wasn't really expensive to import the stuff at the time. There was foreign sellers on the internet where it was becoming a commonplace thing where you had a standard method of payment. You could put in your credit card and you could have something imported. It wasn't a big deal. eBay, people were selling stuff.
True. I also think that they Sony. I mean, by the end of its lifespan, the PlayStation had probably thousands of games or whatever it was, but. I think again. I really feel like to be able to port from the PC was huge because the PlayStation wound up getting a lot of crap that were PC ports or something like that. But you know they were just lost in the shuffle, so they weren't draconian like Nintendo saying, "Well, you know this is not going to come out unless it's got our seal of approval on there." You know, I mean, if you look at the PlayStation game that's not you know first party, it just says PlayStation. That's it. And there's no seal of approval or any of that nonsense.
Yeah, there was, you know, PlayStation also had a bit of the beginnings of shovelware on the shelves, what we saw in the United States, which, you know, I mean, there was garbage released for Atari, and there was garbage released for Nintendo.
Right,
and there
was but they were... A lot of
garbage.
But
it
Sony,
was scrutinized garbage.
Yeah, I know. But Sony was not... they were loose enough about it that... You know, like I said, Working Designs could port all kinds of stuff from Japan. A lot of developers bought stuff in from Japan. A lot of developers, you know, constructed just crazy things. I was looking at a game today in a store. It was Skull Monkeys.
Oh, I love Skull Monkeys.
It was a great game.
Fantastic platformer.
Would that have come out on a Nintendo system?
It was a DreamWorks production.
Right, or Sega. You know, I'm just saying, like, if anything else, would it have come out because... They would have said, "Well, we don't know. No, you can't put this out. This means this, and this means that, and you know, we don't want this on our system." So
yeah, so Sony really embraced.
So for every Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen game, there was a Skull Monkeys.
Yeah, yeah. The ratio we often talk about any console or portable's ratio of good to crap.
Mm.
The volume, the sheer volume of software available on PlayStation in the U.S. region alone, there's a ton of crap, but you could sit here all day and rack your brain, and Greg throws out Skull Monkeys, which is one of my all-time favorites on the system, and I hadn't put it on like my list of favorites that I had just because there's so much. And my personal library of PlayStation games is pretty big. I have a couple hundred, I think, at home. And you know, and I cherry-picked. I really did. Towards the end, I got rid of the stuff that was, you know, garbage, and I kept my favorites, and I still have a couple hundred. It's in a wonderfully large and robust.
The number of
genres.
Oh, every genre.
The number of genres that were on the system. Now nowadays, you know, every system has every genre known to man. But then nobody else. No one did that. Now it wasn't possible in some of the older 8-bit days to do a Skull Monkeys or. You know, even or an ESPN like extreme game,
Tony Hawk Pro Skater.
Yeah, you couldn't do those then. But with the PlayStation, it was possible, and they allowed it.
Yep. And I love one of the things I love. I was thinking about today as I was driving over. I was like, I can't really think of other than maybe some collections on 8-bit computers like Commodore 64 or Atari, compilations of arcade hits the way that they were. Released on PlayStation, like Midway and Williams. Namco and Williams,
mm-hmm.
they you know took collections of great games that could easily each be sold for $10, $20, $30 a piece, and they gave you like 10 on one disc. Say like you know, here's Pac-Man and Galaga and Rally X and Pole Position all on one thing. And it was like, wow.
Well, they started to do that in 16-bit, but it was only like three games on there.
Yeah, and but those were like, you know, you wouldn't get the, you'd get like Pac-Man and like maybe two Junkers on there that like, you know,
Tetris and Dr. Mario bargain bin. Or something like that.
But I love how it's kind of like the genesis of like the greatest hits or the compilation collections of arcade titles.
There were decent ports too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. The emulation was outstanding for the fact that it had to be wrapped in an emulator. I mean, they were. The Namco and the Williams stuff were running arcade, you know, ROMs essentially in custom made emulators. So it's really cool that they were able to do that. And some of Digital Eclipse's best emulation work, I think, was on the PS1 era stuff. I love their work in compiling Williams and Atari's arcade classic stuff, but I think they. Some of their versions of their stuff is better on the PS1 than it was on the PS2 and later the PS3. I think they, you know, different hardware architecture. They have to probably do different things to get certain, you know, color schemes or sounds to work right on a PS2. But it all worked really well on PS1.
And of course, just this summer there was something up my alley, but the New Horizons probe, which was a NASA robotic craft that we sent out there, I don't know, 7 years ago to Pluto, so that the, you know, the human race, first time we've ever seen Pluto up close and its moons, and on one of the seats, there's many processors on a spacecraft because there's not like a central CPU like a PC that does everything. Everything is very very modulated. And on one of the systems, the onboard system, it used the MIPS MIPS R3000 processor, which was in the Sony PlayStation.
Yep.
20 years ago. And people say, "Well, how's that possible? 20 years ago?" Well, the reason they do it is because that particular processor on the spacecraft is doing something very mundane. It's not doing anything. You know, intensive.
Do you mean to tell me that all those great movies from the 1980s, like Space Camp, where they have wacky talking robots that run the spaceships,
Jinx,
and like they move around and they are like, "Oh, I love you," beep beep beep.
Max, this is Jinx. Max. Ugh. Anyway,
those aren't real. They're not. They're not flying the spaceships to Pluto.
Wait, you mean like in the black hole? That stupid hillbilly, broken up guy. Oh, hello there. You know, come on.
What movie is that?
The black hole with
Disney's pre-Tron.
No, it was that black hole was like 79, I think. Yeah,
their pre-Tron live action sci-fi feature.
It was very dark and scary.
Yeah, and not very exciting.
No, but anyway, the processor doesn't have to do a lot. And the reason that NASA uses that kind of a processor is that it's that old. They want something that has been tried and tested for 10 years, because the thing's going to be out there for 30 years. So. That's the reason. So that's just a nice tie-in, you know, the 20th anniversary and the...
So PlayStation got us to Pluto.
Yeah, and I would say the hardware is pretty damn robust. You know, when it was that those first-gen models that were being run, like, for 10 hours a day because people were playing their Resident Evils or Final Fantasy VIIs nonstop and burning out their lasers, you know, there's a lot of hardware-related issues Sony had to keep revising. But I'd say most PlayStation 1s that are sitting in the closet now, they'll still work okay if you power them up. And, you know, they don't have, like, capacitors that, like, blow up or leak or have audio issues or anything like that. If they worked okay when you put it away, it probably still works just fine, I'd say. They're pretty rough stuff. Especially these PlayStation 1s.
Oh, they last for
these are fantastic pieces of hardware. I really like these.
Pillows.
And they made that wonderful LCD screen.
Yeah.
You can put it in your pocket if you're wearing cargo pants.
Nobody wears cargo pants.
Hey, I'm wearing cargo pants. Behind this desk, this table. It's awesome. Right. So, 20 years, and I think that Sony's legacy will continue. They're currently doing really well with the PlayStation 4. They've done a lot of course correcting in the past generation, they had some stumbles with the PlayStation 3. By the end of the generation, they had made up some slack that they had had in the beginning, and they made some great hardware decisions with PlayStation 4, and I think that we will continue to see the legacy that they created with PlayStation 1. We will continue to see their software reissued in different various forms on their current consoles and portables, the same way that Nintendo gives us Super Mario Brothers and Metroid and, you know, all those games repackaged for modern systems. We're going to keep seeing games like, what do we got there? Castlevania, right. Symphony of the Night, things that are classic, timeless, Metal Gear Solid. You know, they've aged well. And
by the way, have you played the new Metal Gear Solid
5? 5? I have only played the prologue, the Ground Zero. Right. Ground Zeros. Have you played 5?
No, I don't have a new system. I'm just wondering.
I watched a little bit of it. Friend had it. It's okay.
Yeah.
You know, you get to send horses up into space.
Yeah, you put balloons on people and shoot them into space. Yes. But that's for a modern podcast. That's not us. But it is cool that, you know, what Metal Gear wasn't born on PlayStation, but it really became a phenomenon on PlayStation and has carried on to the modern generation. And we continue to see a lot of stuff like that from franchises that were born on PlayStation live on today. And they're really healthy thanks to the millions and millions of games that they've sold on PlayStation 1. So, happy birthday, PlayStation. You're 20 this year. I'll buy you a beer when you're 21 next year. We'll take you out to a strip club. So, see you next year.
Welcome back. We've covered this subject before, but since there is a Kickstarter that I think is supposed to start
very soon.
Supposed to start
tomorrow.
Soon.
I don't know.
By the time this goes up, it could possibly be. Yeah, we'll look it up. Yeah. But continue on, sir.
Yes. So we're going to talk about the Retro VGS home console system. Which is being done by the same people who did the Retro Magazine, which I love and adore, and I'm very thankful that they decided to do that project, and I've supported it on both Kickstarters. Retro VGS, which is, of course, the system that will reuse the molds of the Atari Jaguar.
And the molds of the
cartridges, right?
Yes, the cartridge the Jaguar molds. Cartridges. Jaguar, both cartridge molds and console molds, and the mold, allegedly not the internals, of the Wii U Retro Pro controller, which you can find on Amazon, or some variation of that name. It looks like a controller with a Super Nintendo controller with a Xbox 360 style controller molded around it. Aesthetically looks very nice. In your hands, it feels very good. The actual ones that they produced for Wii, and this may not be the case for the Retro VGS, because they allege that they will completely re-engineer the internals. The one that I used for Wii U was one of the worst controllers I have ever used on any console. No hyperbole, no exaggeration. Go to Amazon, look up the reviews for that controller, overwhelmingly bad reviews.
Maybe so. that's how they were able to get the molds.
Quite possibly. there may be, you know, the molds might have been fire sale. Like, oh, we're not making any more of these things.
What was the issue with the ones that you used?
Bad action on both analog sticks, the D-pad, all the buttons. Really unresponsive. I would play games on the Virtual Console. I tried playing the full disc-based games. It was just flaky. Connection issues with the Bluetooth. It's advertised to function as a Wii U Pro controller, which is a very specific thing. It does not do that. It works as the Pro controller that Nintendo sold for the original Wii that goes into the Wiimote, and it can only be used in Wiimote as that. It has limited functionality in Wiimote mode on the Wii U. It's just a mess. It looks really nice. It's a very nice-looking controller, and if they can re-engineer the thing to work with the Retro VGS, more power to them. But it's a hot steaming pile of garbage for the Wii U.
Alright. So, the Retro VGS. So, this has been a project that was announced for a while, and I believe they did have a Kickstarter initially, which was to probably, I think, to pay for the molds, more or less. But they did produce several translucent Jaguar molds, which I guess some Jaguar fans were happy about. And they shipped those.
Your replacement molds for your home Jaguar, you can swap out the standard black.
Right, even though there's nothing wrong with the black.
Other than the fact that the console itself is ugly. It's right. One attachment away from looking like a toilet bowl.
Right. It looks like one of those like horseshoe crabs.
Yes.
That you find on
dead at Seaside.
So, Retro VGS. Here's what I gleaned in terms of what it was going to do initially. Was that it was going to be a proprietary console design. It would not be Android. It would not be, iOS.
A RISC-based processor of their own construction.
And the OS would be something, again, proprietary, I guess. It would not be Android or anything like that. Now, it would take cartridges. This would be the first cartridge-based console system, non-portable, since N64. Yeah, I mean, it's been forever. So that was the other big part of it. And one of the selling points, if you will, was that the retro community and a subset of the retro community, as Frankie likes to say, are ones who collect the classic games, mainly 8-bit, also 16-bit, but they want the games to be complete in the box with the manual and all the whatever else came in it, the cartridge. So this was a way, because the homebrew scene for systems like the Atari 2600, the 5200, 7800, ColecoVision, and Television, these scenes are kind of bustling, if you will, because, you know, even though you can buy individual cartridges, you can also get them complete because there are people who make very, very good boxes and manuals, and everything looks legit. And there's people who go out and they buy them. And each game costs, you know, $50-$60, usually some $40. And that was sort of what we thought the allure was that you would get these 16/32-bit looking kind of games that were retro in retro packaging on a retro system. And that was what we felt was the main selling point. Now, we discussed here, with me trying to be the devil's advocate, that might not sell that well because we didn't feel like the customer pool for such a device was that big.
Right. Games that, you know, homebrews for a system maybe like ColecoVision or Atari 2600 or 5200 or Atari ST or whatever they're making them for. What is an average print run on a game like that? 500?
Very small.
No.
Less than that? 200?
I go even less than that.
Okay, so potentially 100.
Yeah.
At $50 a pop, $60 a pop, maybe $150 for a special edition, like a one-of-a-kind in that set, with a gold plastic autographed by the person doing the homebrews or something.
Yeah.
You know, where's the profit margins on that? I'm not certain if...
And that's based on the fact that the person already owns the system who's buying the game.
Sure.
Not going out to buy a system.
Now, granted, the expectations is the Retro VGS is going to be its own platform with its own pool of enthusiasts. and they're going to try and get those numbers out of the gate, you know, get X amount of people to donate to the Kickstarter. Each one of those people will potentially be a buyer of the system, and they'll get their numbers and all their ducks right. in a row. And then they'll say, okay, our install base is 2,000. You know, if you're going to make a game for the retro VGS, you can almost guarantee you're going to sell maybe 1,500. Yeah, 40 copies, right? That's the real numbers. But they're gonna illustrate to the speculator developers like that are doing these Shovel Knight-type games, like, you know, like, hey, indie developer, we want you to publish on our system.
Well, let me... And this is something that we weren't sure of. Can Shovel Knight... Is that even possible on this system? Is this system powerful enough? Or we just don't know that?
We don't know. I mean, it's up to the... I guess it's up to the developer as to, you know... I mean, you look back at the 8-bit era... What corners can be cut? What can be recoded? What levels can be left out? Or, you know, maybe this thing will be entirely powerful enough to handle something like Shovel Knight, which looks like an 8-bit game, but it's running in an era of processors as powerful as PlayStation 4.
Well, the system would be. Now, the cartridges is a different story.
Sure.
Although, I guess...
This is a thing that came up within the development of this system. A lot of people are upset that the cartridges... will not be flash memory based on the fact that the flash memory is not stable enough for long-term usage. They're saying, well, we could make cartridges that are like, you know, 128 gigs if we use flash memory, but we don't like the rewrite capabilities of that. The cartridges might die in 10 years because
they could die in 10 minutes.
Yeah, flash could just corrupt, you know, if you go to put your cartridge in. It's, you know, could be actively reading or writing something and just die. So instead, we're going to use hard drive, solid-state hard drive type hardware or regular hard drives possibly in the cartridges.
Holy what? Shit.
You guys haven't heard this. No. I'm not making it up.
An SSD hard drive in...
Well,
when was this
possibly not solid-state hard drives. I don't want to... Don't quote me on solid-state, but they were considering actually using hard drives, you know, the size of, like, maybe an iPod hard drive that the classic click-wheel iPods used.
They had hard drives?
Those had hard drives in them, yes. If you turn those classic iPods on, you hold it up to your ear, you can hear a hard drive startup routine. Those... You know, miniature laptop size hard drives. So
this is not like a cartridge, like a Super Nintendo or an N64. Then this is like
based on the size.
This is
I guess
it's like almost like a really big like thumb drive or something like that.
It's a big drive, and they did not want to use flash memory because of the instability of it. Which, you know, that could possibly be a reasonable decision, but it's also going to push up the cost.
Right.
For everybody, for the developers, for the end users, for the publisher. Like, everybody's going to pay more if these cartridges are going to cost upwards of who knows what to manufacture. Bottom dollar on a hard drive, it's got to be expensive, you know? So we're not...
All right, so that's the cartridges. Now, as for the system, I've been hearing some wild things... Wild, wacky stuff lately. At first they were talking like $150 for the console, which I wouldn't pay because it looks like a Jaguar. But but now I'm hearing $300 or $500. Now, obviously, a lot of this is wild and rampant, and I'm not sure.
Could be wild mass guessing.
What's accurate here, but. If we're talking like $300 for a system and the games might cost $100, I know it's not, but this is sounding like Neo Geo territory.
You know, and that was a niche market that is not unlike what this market is going to be.
Well,
like,
no,
I have always...
It is different because the Neo Geos had active arcade hardware. Yeah, they were in the arcades. Right. You know, people wanted
it's
to
a
play
proven,
those at
a
home.
Neo Geo is a proven commodity. Yeah. By the time it was released as a home system, it was already somewhat of a proven commodity. It had something to compare it to, a bar to compare it to. We have not seen much of anything.
It's like original software.
Anything that we've seen running is like Target. Software target examples,
but we've also I've heard that games like you just mentioned, Shovel Knight, or let's say Axiom Verge, or one of these indie games that people are you know, have bought,
excited
about, that these games still, those particular games that are very, very popular, would not come to this system for two reasons. One is that their developers are probably like, what? No. We're not releasing it in this hardware. And then the other is that the retro VGS people themselves seem like they don't want them. That they want to go out and seek developers who are willing to develop exclusively for this system. I don't know where that's going to come from.
Well, again, I mean, they're coming from a perspective of... They're coming from essentially a microcosm. And I think they know this. They're smart. These people...
They made it look like a Jaguar. They're not that smart.
Well, I don't want to... I can't, in good faith, you know, call them... They're ignorant. They're stupid decisions. They're smart. They got to be smart business people to get from point A to point B. Unfortunately, their end goal, I don't think, is attainable. I don't think there is a legitimate market...
Not at that price.
Yeah, at the prices that this is going to be... Not at the cost of each of these cartridges. Yes, there will always be a pool, a subset of classic video game enthusiasts and collectors that will excitedly want to spend money on anything that is new, boxed cartridges that they could put on their shelves, that they can add to their ever-growing collection, that are essentially packaging... Porn people. They like boxes. They like manuals. They like to be able to display things.
Here's the thing, though. It's superficially all of that, because this all seems like a very big hodgepodge of conflicting ideas. The idea, okay, look.
Well, the ideas have been kind of like coming in.
Like, for instance, now I feel like the reason why it looks like a Jaguar is because the Jaguar molds were available.
If it had been the 3DO molds
that have been available, it'd be looking like a 3DO.
That's the majority of the reason they also, I think, did it, because they knew that when they had the Kickstarter, that there was a segment of people, of collectors, who the opportunity... Here's the reason, not to get off subject, but this was done before. This was done by a group who got molds for the Commodore 64 and manufactured... multicolored, including translucent cases for Commodore 64.
But that makes sense, because it's Commodore 64 related.
I understand, but what I'm saying is there was a market for that, and people were like, "Ooh!" But
yeah, those, built-in investor,
right? But kind of those, potential. Even though, but Mike, I'm pretty sure that those cases they had to scratch the Commodore logo out. It doesn't have it.
Okay, I'm sure for the
And they did that for the Jaguar,
for the
Jaguar case.
Trademark issues,
right? But what I'm saying is, they saw that and said, "Oh, well, we can get the Jaguar molds, or they had them already, and if we use these, we could probably sell these molds extra. People will want them." And yes, some people wanted them. So it kind of worked.
It's just that, though, the whole idea of, okay, we're going to make a new system with new games, but that uses old-style hardware just because.
Hardware is going to be new-style hardware, but it will be capable of functioning... Components of it will be able to function like a Nintendo if it needs to, or an Atari if it needs to. It's not emulation.
No.
Strictly.
Well, it is, though. That was the other thing that came out now. Is that now they're talking about, this is from the retro people,
yep.
That they're talking about putting the emulation cores for 16, or at least 8-bit systems.
8-bit systems, for sure.
Yeah, which is, again, more of this hodgepodge of ideas, because it's like a bunch of ideas
that's like a wish list thing. We want to have that. Yeah. I mean, the Retron 5 is great, but it doesn't have 2600, it doesn't have ColecoVision, blah, blah, blah. But now, that's a wish list. But what's the reality? They're talking about manufacturing cartridge adapters to go into the retro VGS cartridge adapter, and then you plug your 2600 cartridge onto that. And I'm thinking, well, where's the R&D money going to come from that? for all these cartridge adapters. Yeah.
Do they have molds for that that they could buy from somewhere? These will have to be engineered themselves.
And if you're going that direction, why not just make a clone system that plays everything? Why bother with this whole like new software in Jaguar cartridges?
Well, that's
what
I mean. Again,
it's like it doesn't. It's not connected.
It's like
two or three different products that are just like.
I agree. Competing. I can't imagine personally. I cannot imagine that when the Kickstarter comes out, there is a mention of these cartridge adapters. That was, I think, a knee jerk reaction to, you know, all the criticism that they've gotten, and I think you're right. If you're going to have a knee jerk reaction, then allow the system to take an SD card with ROMs. You're going to put the emulation cores on there for 2600? Well, let me stick some ROMs in there.
And if you don't want emulation, then just make a clone hardware that has been done, like the earlier Retrons. I mean, that's always an option, too.
Well, that's not going to sell.
I know, but I'm just saying, at least that would have, at least that would be a cohesive idea. Would have some sort of basis, like some rational basis for existing.
Yeah, I mean, like you're, again, like they have come from a world where they saw what they consider to be a potential for a big profit based on the activities of people who are enthusiasts for classic games delivered at retail the way they used to be delivered. They don't like this movement towards this digital frontier of, like, even though there are plenty of modern games that have a retro aesthetic and play like classic games, like you feel like you're playing a Nintendo game when you're playing Shovel Knight, but the fact that you can't go out and buy a Shovel Knight cartridge with like a plastic snap case and put it on your shelf and open the Shovel Knight booklet and smell that freshly inked glossy paper, that's the people they're marketing to.
Why aren't they using discs though? So that's the thing, because it's like they're using like the nostalgia.
Why aren't
for
they using
it, well, because like the nostalgia for the crappy parts of the, you know, it's like trying to sell things. It's like trying to sell movies on VHS tapes now. You know, selling a Blu-ray player that you have to rewind.
But if you market, if you went out there and you got on the internet and had a Kickstarter and said like, I want my movie experience the way it was when I was a kid, when it was the good old days, when you'd go out to Blockbuster Video and you'd pop open those hard plastic rental boxes and you love the sound of the VHS scraping into the oddly shaped player with the plastic flap on the front,
and the
sound of the eight heads whirring, and
if you never rewind, you got charged extra.
And those beautiful rainbow colored statics that would be on your old TV set. Like, if you market anything like hard enough, and you sell it as nostalgia or classic or retro, you're gonna get somebody's attention, and they're gonna write a comment on your Kickstarter. Take my money now! I'm so excited.
It's like a VHS copy of like the Avengers or something like that. Like, but that's kind of like
the way movies used to be.
Yeah, that's kind of what that feels like. Here, we want new games, but we want to sell them in a way that that absorbs all the crappiness.
Here's something I've
had. None of the benefits of having those old games we liked those old games because they were good games.
You're right. Not because
they came on cartridges.
Came on cartridges. Here's something I have a fundamental problem with. Allegedly, the retro VGS, there will be no patches. No updates.
Unbelievable.
That makes no sense.
No updating the operating system. No updates to the cartridges. No way of fixing. When you buy that copy of whatever game it is, and you get to level 5, and there's a catastrophic bug that prevents you from finishing that game, you have another copy of Cheetah Men for NES or something that there's no physical
impossible
way of
mission.
Beating it. Right, impossible mission. There's no physical way of completing that game. And, okay.
Your SOL.
Is that a good thing about classic gaming? Is that something we've taken such great strides in the past two decades to erase those things from happening. Yes, there are interesting.
Yeah, but you could easily say, if you look at classic gaming, you could probably come up with a half dozen examples of that, and then I don't know how many. I mean, I've tens of thousands of games. It was actually rare that something like that happened because they tested them. Mm-hmm. I would be extremely leery of any of these games being 100% tested the way that they used to do, and not to mention even the way that, say, an Activision or
Capcom.
Blizzard or Capcom or Sony, test them now. I just, they're not going to be able to do them to that level. They will not have the manpower to do it to that level. It just won't.
And if they do, then the games might be actually fairly like basic. If they, you know, cause, I mean, in order to test a game thoroughly,
yeah, they, I mean, the, is that, is if that they're very hinder,
basic, if they're extremely basic games, you might be
hinder
able to.
The potential creativity of the developer, knowing like shit, I got to get this right the first time. I mean, like some of them are perfectionists, and they may just like bow out and say like, not if I can't patch this. If somebody figures out an exploit or something that's wrong or something that's broken, I don't want to develop for a system that doesn't have any opportunity to do that. Sure, there may be some hobbyist type developers that are excited about the prospect and, you know, buy with the knowledge that you're potentially buying a game that has only been playtested by the person who developed it, you know, in their house or in their garage or their basement or wherever they coded that game. That might be the only playtesting it ever got. And you might get to a point where the game's broken and that's it. I mean, I hope not. I don't wish that on anybody, and I don't. I would hope that developers have the sense not to let something like that happen. But this notion that it's better because we can't fix it, because we can't update it, because that's the good old days. That's ridiculous. We're above that.
And it's always going to be about the apps. And the reality is, the Retron 5 sold because people who bought it are using their original cartridges from those systems, and those systems obviously have stood the test of time because they were very successful then. They have had great games that are still great. So that's the reason that system sold. We've talked to death systems like the Ouya, for instance, which more or less didn't do much, and other similar, say, Android consoles. And you know, I had a chance. A friend of mine got the NVIDIA. It was called the NVIDIA Shield console, but now it's called Android. Everything is now Android TV. That's like Android. They're calling everything Android TV now. And we were trying to play it, and the TV functionality of this device was fantastic. I mean, it had every TV app you could think about, and they all worked great. And you could put other Android apps on there, too. But when we got... And there was emulators and things like that, but and games that you could buy off of the store.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you got to things like, let's say, all right, I want to put a Commodore 64 emulator on there, and it's not in their Play Store because it hasn't been fully vetted for that console yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now you got to sideload it, for instance. But my point is, that system is, right out of the gate, is an entertainment system. It's a streaming system. It is a game system also, but it's not, its main function is not gaming. And so I think what's happened is a lot of these, micro consoles and things like that, they've come and gone, and I think the manufacturers have kind of gotten the word now that, you know, these are, even those are niche. And you know something? But we got to put the entertainment on there because people are probably going to use this thing to watch movies. I mean, I'm sure people do it with the PS4 and the Xbox.
People did it with Ouya, you know? Like, the XBMC is like one of the top downloaded things on Ouya.
Yeah.
Like,
people were not happy when they found that the original Wii could not play DVDs.
Yeah.
That was a legitimate complaint.
The GameCube, But my point being that, not saying that people aren't using them to play games, what I'm saying is the feasibility of these systems for gaming, for majority gaming, is not there. And the reason it's not there is because the apps aren't there. The apps are on PS4 and Xbox One and
right.
Wii U.
Well, I mean that's the sales pitch for this thing, though. That's understood, I think. I don't think anybody's going to look at a retro VGS, whether they're casual or niche enthusiasts, and go like, oh, but does it have Netflix? Like, they know. It's kind of retro. This is retro. It's cartridges, and it's gonna be like the old machines. The problem is, you know, you got a big pie chart, and like the little sliver of like 10% of this massive pie chart are the people that are really excited about playing the games the old way.
And did I mention that those people are frugal?
Some of them are. Some of them spend wildly, which is probably where the cartoon dollar signs popped out of their eyes when they said, like, hey, that's a great idea, let's do this. But, you know, those I don't know if they're viable. They're like a huge. All right, not, so there's not enough of those guys and girls.
So, but all right, so the three of us are not the really the target audience.
No, not at all.
Probably if anyone, I am, and even I'm not on board because of mainly because of the Jaguar thing. But so I don't go on the Facebook page, and I'll get to that in a second. The issues people have had with the Facebook page, but I'm on Atari Age website, the forum. All the time. And Atari Age really is the place for that era of system and collecting.
And those homebrews that people right. were talking exactly. about, where people buy those special edition yes. homebrews and they'll spend a lot of money on them.
Yeah, the collector vision and those people. And Atari Age themselves, they put them out. And I have to tell you, even it's hard to say what the sampling is, because only certain people are you know, mouthing off there. But it's the Retro VGS has several different threads that were started for different reasons, and they're pretty much, I'd say, probably 90% negative to them. And these are people, again, who, as Frankie has said, this is the these people are target audience. Like, the conceptually, they want something like that, but they're completely against it. One of it is the price, all the other hardware issues that we've mentioned. And I said this in private to us amongst ourselves. I think when you've lost the Atari Age crowd, I don't know where you go from that point. I mean, that is the target.
That's the hardcore of hardcore.
Yeah, that is. They have not even launched their Kickstarter yet. Last Thursday, they posted on the Facebook page. You said you don't go on it.
Right.
They had a. The Retro VGS people posted, and it says, "Hello, everyone. I wanted to address our decision to remove some posts from our Facebook page."
Oh, no.
And it goes on.
Yeah,
they've it's gotten to a point where the negative criticism is starting to hit a critical mass for them. I believe in the beginning, and from what I witnessed and what I've discussed with our friends on the Our Brooklyn Bites podcast, Leon and Stephanie, and with you guys, and with other people at our NAVA meetings, is like. In the beginning, there seems to be this overwhelming wave of positivity, and I just kind of confused me more than anything. I was like, "Where are the doubters? Where like it was like every single response to their post was like, "I can't wait for this. This is going to be the greatest thing ever. This is a return to form for classic gaming. Take my money, please. Take my money. Take my firstborn kid." Now.
Yeah.
That as they reveal more and more of the specifications of the system...
Which keep changing.
The price of the system, which keeps changing. People are starting... You're starting to get more of the vocal doubters and the vocal critics. And I think the Retro VGS people got a little complacent with the positivity in the beginning. And now they're like, oh boy... This is a lot of negativity and a lot of public negativity and a lot of people, you know, talking about how this could fail in various different ways. And I think the biggest mistake that the Retro VGS people have made are that they don't have a professional marketing department behind them. They don't have somebody to keep their message like on point 24 hours a day. And what they're doing is they're responding to some of this a lot of the criticism. They're interacting with the critics like head on, which is a noble attempt, something to do when you get this kind of criticism online. But it's also like can be your undoing in a heartbeat. You get into a one-on-one discussion with somebody who really wants to take you apart, and you know you really wind up just blowing any goodwill that you had almost immediately.
Especially when you start deleting negative posts.
Yeah,
that's sort of the last straw for a lot of people. A lot of the people who were maybe silently being politely silent.
Yeah,
those people on the fence who maybe they don't like the idea of the thing, maybe they're critical of it. But
I think a lot of people just didn't think it would ever happen.
Yeah, but they're just being really they're being polite, they're being quiet about it, they're not really being vocal. The minute you start seeing that sort of Orwellian, that revised history kind of thing, we're going to erase the negativity, then you lose their sympathy.
Well,
you lose a lot of sympathy.
Wasn't it you said that every professional company in the world that runs a Facebook page has somebody monitoring and taking stuff down, but it's The problem here is that, like, they don't even have a product yet.
Yeah.
And, well, they're taking stuff down.
I said this on Atari Age to some people. I said, well, every company does this. I mean, you know, this was like when the Nintendo, one of the translators for the languages got fired because he gave a podcast interview. And I'm like, well, and my reaction to that was, well, yeah, you work for the company, you can't talk about these things. It's part of the agreement. You know, but, and it was a similar thing. But if you go on, let's say, Target's website and you scream bloody murder, what will happen is eventually someone will probably see it, and then they'll contact you, and they might probably delete it or something like that. But I'm almost okay with that, because you got to be wary of trolls and idiots who are just bad-mouthing you for no reason. But what you can't remove are, like, reviews. So if you have a product, or you have a, if your Facebook page is for a product or a restaurant or something like that, somebody puts a bad review, Facebook doesn't allow you to take that off because it's a review. But that's not what these are. However, I was corrected on Atari Age by someone who basically said that, no, they weren't removing simply trolling, negative, bad-mouthing posts. They were removing posts of people who had legitimate concerns and weren't overly, like, nasty about
it. Just, like, asking questions.
Yeah, people were like, well, you know, why are you doing it this way? When you said this, and now you're saying that. And they were just calling them to task. And rather than, I guess in some cases, they were digging themselves a hole by responding. In other cases, just deleting it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, personally,
it's a difficult.
I would say the best move that they could have made is, like Mike said, remain politely silent.
Yeah.
Let people who, I mean, and it's tough because we know the classic gaming community is incredibly passionate and incredibly vocal, and they spend a lot of time online. Yeah. So it's like it would be a steady, endless stream of
the mistake,
doubt and criticism.
The mistake they've made is they have taken what should have been internal product development decisions and communication,
yes,
and
absolutely,
they've thrown it out to
absolutely
everybody. What are you doing?
Excitedly, like you know, hey, you guys have an inside view as to,
there's a reason why we don't see every step of development from the Xbox One or like the PlayStation 4.
No, it's like, you know, when a Kickstarter comes out, usually the product is pretty much done, at least the conceptual design of it. And that's what we all thought, but you know, it's just the moving goalposts and all that, and people are now just like, whoa, what's happening here? And so they've just handled it very, very poorly. I mean, an example I have is there's, you know, I always put in those flash carts and things like that, and we've been talking about the PlayStation, and there was a couple of guys who are in other countries, and they've been working on an SD card interface called PSIO. That goes onto the PlayStation. And there's some issues with that itself and that device. But the guy who wanted to do it, and he's in Australia, he got battered on the Assembler Games forum, where he had been for a while, and he was talking it up. And people just hammered him. And the reason was that people held a grudge because of something he had with some guy in there. I don't know, some issue. And so
people on a video game forum holding a grudge for a long time over stupid shit. Wow, doesn't ever happen. It's never happened to me.
They bashed this guy, his project, for like 2 years. Just bashed it to no end. And finally, I was one of the people who said, look, I think you should stop responding here because you're being destroyed. You don't have a working
control. You're taking the bait.
Believe it. They were like, no, we don't believe this. Every time the guy would do like a new revision and show it, they're like, well, that's fake. That's not from the PlayStation. That's coming from your PC. And so finally I was like, look, you should stop responding here. And so what he did was he had his own forum on his own, and all of the guy's information goes on that forum and that forum only. He doesn't respond anywhere else. And the reality is, on that forum, it's been taking a long time, but the reality is, they are close to a finished product, and they haven't had to respond to people smashing them. And that's what you have to do when you're developing something. You know, you don't just say, well, you know, this is everything. You know, it's like if somebody had if I came in with a box of Legos, of all kinds of different Legos, just threw them out on the table and said, here, put together a new Lego set without instructions. It's just, it's crazy. So, oh, well.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, we have not even seen a beginning of a Kickstarter for this. We speculate that a couple things. It could be a catastrophic disaster. You know, I think that the kind of movement that you see in the Kickstarter on this in the very beginning, like most Kickstarters, is going to be indicative of their long-term goal achievement. Like if they get a lot of money on day one, they might be able to get similar capital in a home stretch scenario.
Well, it's also going to depend on the number they put out there. If they put $500,000, my God, it's going to be a troll fest.
Yeah. It's got to be a reasonable number.
All right.
And also, I think that there could be a possibility that, based on the kind of confidence that I see from them, despite the criticism and everything else, that the level of kind of development that it has to this point, to me, says that they probably have some level of investment or backers that have money that is waiting to go, mm-hmm. and that the Kickstarter is going to be a small Kickstarter that's going to be a very reasonable amount of money, and then once that is successful, that the investors will pony up more of the capital.
Well, I'm
just speculating, and I'm not calling them like frauds or that they're doing anything like shady.
No, I don't think there's anything fraudulent about this. I just think the ideas are really out there.
With Sony and the Shenmue Kickstarter, it was a low-numbered Kickstarter for a big game development because Sony had a lot of money that they were like, you have to prove to us that this Kickstarter is, you know, going to work, and then we'll give you the rest of it.
Yeah, the Mighty No. 9 is the same thing. They were going to make that regardless. But our fearless leader, Joe Santulli, has often told us about the leader of the retro project, Mike Kennedy. He said, you know, somehow, one way or another, Mike gets these things done. So that's the only thing that I'm kind of thinking, you know, this will get done in some fashion, because he's somehow been able to do it.
Yeah, I think we're going to see it. Ugh. And I think it's going to have games. Mm. The question I have...
Should you buy it day one? Buy all the games, hoard them, just one set of everything, hoard it.
Flip them on eBay.
And flip it in like 3 years.
But that's the thing. I think the question isn't necessarily whether it's going to be made or whether there's going to be games for it. I think we know that, this is if the Kickstarter turns out well, this is going to happen. The thing is, what's the end game here? To release the thing for like $200 and have like four games and that's it, just to say you did it?
My question
if that's it, then great, then go for it. But if it's if that,
my question is when that inevitably happens, when it gets released, they go through all the R&D, they develop the entire console, it's on, you know, available online for order for a year with a library, maybe 10-15 games at the end of the day. Do they themselves ever admit that it's anything other than a wild success for classic gaming? Will they concede, if it is a failure, will they... I mean, historically, has there ever been a company that's done that?
You can't. I mean,
Nintendo never even called the Virtual Boy a failure. No. You know, like, are they ever going to say, like, oh, well, we tried. Yeah. You know, I think...
The closest you get is like we talked about with the Saturn with Virtual Fighter. That's the closest you get.
Yeah. Will there
be? They're not going to do revisions, so forget it.
Yeah. There's not. If you find a bug on your cartridge, it's a feature.
It just depends on what they want out of this thing. If they want to put this thing out with a couple of games just to have it out there. Then they could do that. But if they want this to be like an ongoing thing where more games come out every couple of months, there's a new game being released, I don't know. It's a stretch.
There's a part of them that wants this to be a milestone in the history of classic gaming, but I have to assume they want money. Yeah. This has got to be for profit. This isn't just like, you know, Joe Santulli and John Hardy and Sean Kelly have said multiple times that they did Classic Gaming Expo most times out of their own pocket with no profit to be turned because they wanted to do it because they loved doing it. You know, there was a break-even affair for them or less. I don't think that Mike Kennedy is doing this for a break-even affair or less. I think he wants to make some money, you know, and everybody involved probably wants to make some money. And they,
well, I suppose they can do that if their goal is just to get it out there with a couple of games. But
man, you know, they must really have like worked the numbers on this, like between getting those Jaguar molds and
there's no way. Let's face it, in the history of gaming, we have learned that, especially nowadays, that you don't make money on consoles. You make money on licensing for the software.
Right? Well, it depends on how much they sell the console for and how much the hardware costs them.
What are they going to sell for? $900?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that might be why they're jiggering with the price so much. Nah. I don't know.
Oh, well.
Yeah. All right, we'll see. We will revisit Retro VGS again, inevitably, in the future, because we just can't stop talking about it in our personal lives.
Will we be eating crow on this?
Hey,
this
you know what? If we are, then we are.
I don't wish.
We're finding a crow. You know, it's
I said it last time. I'll say it again. Let the record state, I do not wish them to fail. No. I don't want to see this, you know, be a train wreck.
Listen, if it works, it works. And I'll be the first.
My concern, and I've said this before, is I love the magazine. I don't want the whole company to go out of business. It's not going to make the magazine anymore.
Oh, because of this,
anymore.
Yeah. It's
so we'll see. We will revisit. Favorite segment and your favorite segment as well, the show and tell.
Show and tell. Oh, okay.
So did you bring enough for everyone in the class?
No. All right, so none of these are crazy or anything, but we've been talking about 20th anniversary of the PlayStation, so I brought just a selection of games. But these are not simply to talk about games, it's to talk about the actual like packaging of them. So... and how that they sold. So, first of all, if we look at the regular jewel cases, I don't collect long boxes. You had a case where Crash 2 had a kind of lenticular... take it out. I didn't do it. Yeah, so there's like a lenticular card that came in the jewel case, which is cool. There's a little 3D there. Sort of like the old sports flicks, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Crash is kind of like three-dimensional.
Yeah, and then that would be the regular one. I have Contra Legacy of War, which a lot of people hate. This came with 3D glasses. I don't know what I did with them. I may not even have them for this, for all I know. But it was I don't know if you could see on the... But you can't really see. But it had two modes. It would switch... The regular, and then it would switch to like a 3D mode. And
this copy belonged to Mary Kate and Ashley.
I guess somebody named Olsen had it at one point. That was that game. It's an okay game. It's like a top-down thing. And Silent Hill. This was kind of cool. This one has it's a popular series. And this one originally came. Actually, the black label is a lot harder to get. And it was
nice
like a
silver
weird, kind of silver thing.
Yeah, there was
scary.
A later printing of the game that did not have that.
In the greatest hits.
Yeah, kind of metallic ink. Very cool.
That is Splurge. We talked about this earlier, Castlevania Symphony of the Night. Obviously, I made sure I got the black label and not the greatest hits. Tomb Raider, we talked about. All right, now.
A classic.
Hold on. So start at the bottom. So there, you know, a lot of the PlayStation games, Dreamcast also had these double jewel cases,
mostly to fit larger instruction manuals.
Right. So sometimes I think it's just a waste, but this is Alundra, which is a action RPG, I guess, working design. So yeah, it has like a useless, you know.
Yeah, there's no CD.
There's nothing
there.
and then the actual manual, which I guess it is thicker.
Yeah, that wouldn't fit in a regular jewel case.
And it has, you know, it's embossed and everything. It's very nice.
Yeah, working designs, it was like the Cadillac of PlayStation game developers in terms of you get all the bells and whistles in the boxes. Right. They put cloth maps and all kinds of neat stuff. All
right, then you go to, like, say, Metal Gear Solid, and this one actually has two discs. So there's the first disc. As we all know, let me take the out there. And then, as you said, a very thick manual Metal Gear had.
It's not about the length of the manual, it's about the width, the girth.
The thickness. And then, the back end, there's the other disc.
Yep.
It's a very long game.
I believe, if memory serves correctly, the PlayStation disc case that housed the most games was Ribbon at a whopping 6 or 7 discs.
I think Ark the Lad Collection had like 5 too, so that was like a lot.
Yeah, so there would be one disc on this side, one disc on the inside, and then it would actually have another disc underneath. They got pretty complex towards the end.
So that was the X-Files. This was the X-Files game, which had all kinds of FMV. Very good quality for the time.
They produced like an episode worth of material specifically for the game.
And there's the manual. And this is a 4-disc game, so the manual was pretty thin. Then there's disc 1, 2, and then 3 and 4. I think Wing Commander was kind of like this too. So it's 4 discs. Now, the reason I have this was I also brought something X-Files related. The X-Files is coming back in January, of course. I'm very excited. And this is the PC version of the X-Files game. Yeah. It's one of the few PC games.
The same one produced by Fox.
Yeah. It's one of the few PC games that I've actually held on to. Because the box. I love the box. He's not looking at the box.
Sorry. I was.
And it worked on Power Mac and Windows 95.
Nice.
Yeah. Jeez. So there it is, yeah. So it has, you know, the little cutout there, X-Files. When you open it up, it has the actual case for the game. There's the manual in there and some other stuff. And the, oh, look at that. It's shiny.
Man, that is one.
Changes colors. And then inside,
it's actually crazy. Files.
7 discs. 7.
Wow.
So, there it is.
Do they probably have higher resolution video
definitely.
PC version.
I don't know what the actual resolution is. It probably stinks now.
I'm sure this entire game, you could just watch it on YouTube.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. And in fact, I think there was once a code, or once you built it, beat it, you could actually just watch it all the way through. It was kind of boring, to be honest. Just watching it, all the cutscenes.
So most episodes of the X-Files.
Oh, come on. So that's the X-Files game. And then PlayStation related, last but not least. Oh, there was one other thing. I've had this for a while. This is the Jap. You know me, I love my light guns. I'm part of the. I'm not like the NRA. I'm like the NLA.
The NLA,
the National
Light Gun Association.
They're coming for my light guns. You can't take away my light guns.
That's from my cool dead hand. And so this is the regular PlayStation 1 Namco gun.
The gun con.
But the gun con. But it's the Japanese version, so it's black. It's not gray.
Sure to get you killed if you step outside.
And I got this for $5 at a flea market from a friend of ours, and. I probably won't keep it because I already have 2 of the gray ones. But the Namco, of course, had the regular controller, the port, and it had this like pass-through composite video adapter that you needed. You had to plug it into the system, and then that went in there.
What was that for?
This?
Yeah.
You got a more accurate.
And then for light guns, there was this device that they made for the PlayStation. I think there's been aftermarket. Things of this too. This is the it's like a pass through. So there's also one where it just has the composite video. It's a lot shorter. This one has the stereo audio. So what you would do is you would plug this in to the AV out of the PlayStation, And then on this side, I guess, what is it, daisy chained? No. You plug this in here.
Yeah.
And then your regular AV cable would go into the back. And then you could siphon out the audio and the video right from there. I don't know what good this was back in the day, but for me, the way my setup is, this is handy because I don't have to go into like the back of the TV to unplug and plug and stuff, and I can just do it right here.
Yeah.
And it's a lot easier.
This was necessary for PlayStations that didn't have these breakout ports on the back.
True, yes.
If you wanted to plug this piece in into the PlayStation, not into the back of the TV set.
Right.
Which, with the short length of this cord, it's not likely that you could get it.
And then this is a, I just picked this up recently. I went down to the Next Level Video Games in, I think it's in Blackwood, New Jersey, South Jersey. And I found this. It's a, I've been looking for this. It is the Sega Genesis Multitap, the Sega brand. This one is the version MK1647. And the Sega branded one they originally came out with only had one wire. So you would plug the wire into controller 1, and then you could use controller 2 as a regular controller. And you could actually have 5 controllers because it had the other 4 ports here. EA came out with their own, which was like a device that, yeah, it just had a box with the 4 and only worked on EA games. And this one only worked on the non-EA games. So what? Eventually, Sega finally came to their senses. They made one where it works on both. So, and it's very picky-choosy. So there's some games where you have to plug in, like EA, you plug in both wires into the ports, and then you switch it to the extra, and then it works on EA. Alternatively, for the Sega, the other stuff, you put it on multi, and it'll work. But some of the games work with both in there, like NBA Jam. And then I tried another multi... multiplayer game that wasn't EA, and it only worked when, I think it was WWF Raw, and it only worked when I took out the second controller wire. It's very confusing. Now, the ABCD basically means if you want to just use one controller at a time, you can just switch.
So if you just have this plugged in permanently.
Yeah, right.
And if you're illiterate, you're shit out.
True. So this was $10, so I jumped on
it. Surprisingly complicated for just multi-tap.
That's Sega for you. I mean, how many... You know, if you got this thing hooked on with the Sega CD and the 32X and the Power Base, you know, it's the Tower of Doom.
Anything else?
No.
All right. I can show my thing. As long as I'm working the camera here. I picked this up at the last NAFA. It was traded for a couple of black box loose NES cartridges. I'd value this at somewhere.
You weren't able to pay for it.
No, I actually, I'm sad to say on the podcast that I broke up my dumpster find collection.
Yeah.
Two of the games from that went towards this, but to me, this is ultimately more important. And you know, I got those games for free, so
true.
It was a pretty even trade, I'd say. I'd estimate the value of this at about $30 or $40. On a good day, possibly more. This is in wonderful condition. This was made by Nelsonic, who did all of the LCD Game & Watch style watches from that era, from the 80s all the way through. God, I think they're still manufacturing based on old molds and old tech that they have. There's, you know, LCD watch technology hasn't really changed at all. And this was a mail-away from Kellogg's cereal. I'm not sure exactly what cereal it was.
Maybe it was Tony the Tiger,
Maybe.
Frosted Flakes.
But it's a Star Fox. Star Fox watch. Let me see if I can get it to play the song. It does the opening tune from Corneria on the Super Nintendo. A pretty good rendition of it, and it's a pretty fun game. Just a straightforward shooter. It's a pretty good version of flying over the planet surface in Star Fox and shooting the enemies and avoiding downed towers. But
you know, I'm not going to spend much time playing it. It's gonna stay on my shelf with all my Game & Watch collection. So you have the Star Fox logo there.
Nice. I always felt that, though, I have the Zelda one from when I was a kid, and yeah. I always felt like, I was like, well, why are these a watch? Because
you can't play it.
You can't play it with one hand. You got to take it off anyway, and you know, use it.
Yeah, they are pretty challenging to play. You can't. It's really tough to play it on your wrist, and taking it off, you know, you're better served actually playing with a real Game & Watch or playing with a Game Boy or a DS or something. But you know, I have an affinity for these LCD games, and I hadn't previously owned any of the Nelsonic watches, and I've always wanted them, so I jumped at the opportunity to pick one up. So what do you have for us, Mike? All
right, this is a one-of-a-kind PlayStation. One-of-a-kind.
Celebrating the 20th anniversary.
Now, the thing is, I got this off of eBay, but I think I got a little ripped off.
Oh, my God!
I think I got a little ripped off.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. All right, the real story behind this.
That is not a PlayStation controller.
No, this is enhanced. This PlayStation uses N64 controllers.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I just, for the viewers at home, I can smell this. I can smell.
Oh, this, wow, yeah, the melted
plastic. And for our listeners, I am looking at what looks like a pile of burnt marshmallow.
It looks like something from, like, an alien movie.
Oh, what was that? Cronenberg Existenz? Those biological consoles that they plugged into them? Yeah, that is an actual...
But turn it over again. Well, no, turn it all the way around. So it's front ways. Yeah.
With front ways, this is the back.
Oh,
it is so deformed that we cannot figure out what is the front or the back. So what's the story?
All right, so the story here is...
Behind this PlayStation console with wires and a Nintendo 64 controller melted into it.
A few years ago, I think I mentioned this on the podcast, that I had a slight fire, right? And part of the experience was that I was I think my life was saved by Final Fantasy VIII, because I happened to be in the basement at the time playing Final Fantasy VIII, which I had bought from this store like a few days prior. This PlayStation and the N64 controller was right next to the start of the fire. When I caught it, and
love that spring.
Yeah, this was when we were talking about
the door spring.
This was the door spring for the
it didn't escape. It tried to spring out, but
it came right to the top. Right, this I think was a Game Shark, one of those memory cards, those Game Shark CDX things.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
So that's like that, you know. And if you go to the Nintendo World Store in Manhattan. In their display case, they have a Game Boy that was...
It was in Desert Storm,
I think. Something like that. Yeah. Like it was in a gigantic explosion, and yet it still works. It's all mangled.
I don't know about this working.
No, I don't
think this is going to work.
It's going to work. Now you plug it in.
Barely any semblance of like letters on those buttons anymore. It's A or B.
Yeah.
I can see an O, like, open. Like, there's an O there.
Mm.
Wow. That is something.
Crispy.
Like, what was that supposed to... Was that the power button?
That's a reset.
That's a reset button, okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't even know if there was a game inside.
what is this, from a key or something?
No, this is probably the spring. This is probably from the control stick.
Mm. Oh, I can kind of almost see inside the lid, but I can't tell if there's an actual game.
If there, it's unlikely. If there was, it was probably this Game Shark disc. But
all those codes lost to time. How will you ever cheat?
But yeah, so this was. I kept this as a memory.
Probably pretty toxic.
This I'm not sure about.
What plug is that from? That
I don't know.
This really is like an
alien.
Like
I have two plugs. I don't know what some of these plugs are.
Composite cables sticking out.
Like, I'm not sure what some of this stuff is.
Wow.
But yeah, it's a very interesting piece.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I'm going to put it away now because it actually really does stink.
It smells. Yeah. It smells like burned everything. Flesh, plastic, wood. All right. Well,
Leo wouldn't take it when I tried to give it to the store. He wouldn't give me anything for it, you know.
Well, season 4 has begun, ladies and gentlemen. We'll catch you next time.